all the acronyms. But he gave a talk out in California, which I guess he has roots in California. I didn't know that. At the one of the major human rights campaign for various sorts of rights, I guess. Anyway, that's well introduced by the hosts of This Way Out, which is on Friday evenings, and I caught it, and I was dumbfounded. I hadn't heard the reporting on this rabble-rousing, calling for mass action and gatherings in the streets. So there's a gathering in the park today, Indivisible Champaign County, I guess. Need to get the specifics of that. That's starting at noon to 2 today, and the variety of weather forecasts. There is a gazebo out at Westside Park now that maybe where the speakers might be if they're worried about the weather. My forecaster says we're going to have a break in the middle of the day from the rainy weather, so not like last week's. I have a bit of outgoing Mayor Marlin's talk, which was pretty good. I don't know whether I'll have time for it, from the CURE, CU Resist Effort event in the rain last week that was so well attended. Expecting a crowd out at Westside Park. Well, I got to speed up myself. More than a little insomniac last night. Let's hear from Amy Goodman. The only thing I have on the free speech Palestine exception discourse that I return to quite a bit. What I do have is the dissident thing on tariffs, and from Mitch Jezerich's interview with Nancy Altman of Social Security Works. He starts out by recounting how he was a Pacifica correspondent in D.C. during the Bush attempt to privatize Social Security. Remember that? I hadn't even thought of that. It's been tried before, and it proved to be the third rail. He said he had not experienced mass demonstrations at the Capitol before that issue hit the fire. No Mumia Abu-Jamal, and I haven't gotten around to trying to parse out some of these other commentaries at Prison Radio. Go to prisonradio.org and see some commentaries from the inside. But here's Amy Goodman breaking the sound barrier to kick it off. Except, why don't I do that underwriting announcement that I said I was going to play? Radio Free Labor coming up somewhat straight away in an hour or so.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts and the listeners of WEFT. April at Krannert Center features Illinois Theater's presentation of Shakespeare's The Winter's Tale from April 4th through the 12th, and playwright, actor, and MacArthur Fellow Taylor Mack in conversation on April 22nd. Complete information on these performances is available online at KrannertCenter.com.
Oh, well-voiced. Okay, here's Amy.
First they came for Mahmoud Khalil. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. The Trump administration's nationwide roundup of international students accused of holding opinions it dislikes is picking up speed, sowing fear, separating families, and driving people underground or out of the country. This targeting appeals to President Trump and his followers as it bolsters three pillars of the MAGA movement. It attacks universities, long reviled as a source of liberal power. It fuels the anti-immigrant fervor, long promoted by people like Trump advisor Stephen Miller. Thirdly, by targeting Palestinian solidarity activists on campus, it amplifies the false narrative that criticizing the state of Israel is anti-Semitic, even though many of the protesters are Jewish, enabling the attacks on academia while providing cover for Israel's resumed ethnic cleansing in Gaza. History teaches us that standing by silently as others are disappeared is a failed strategy, as the next person grabbed off the street by masked agents of the state maybe you. Mahmoud Khalil, a Columbia University grad student until last December, was the first arrested on March 8th. He was a legal permanent resident of the United States with a green card, now revoked. His wife, Dr. Noor Abdullah, is a U.S. citizen who's about to give birth to their first child. 8 months pregnant, she filmed her husband's arrest as she spoke to his lawyer on the phone. She tried to learn the identities of the arresting plainclothes agents as they dragged Mahmoud into an unmarked car. Mahmoud joined in the Palestine solidarity protests at Columbia University last spring and was accepted by both the protesters and the administration as a negotiator. He thus had a prominent public role in the first major protest encampment against Israel's ongoing assault on Gaza, which sparked similar encampments nationwide. This is very likely why he was targeted for deportation. He's been held in an ICE jail in Jena, Louisiana, since March 9th. A federal judge has blocked his deportation while his legal team fights for his release. Days after his arrest, President Trump threatened on his social media site, quote, "This is the first arrest of many to come," unquote. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, addressing the press on March 27th, claimed that at least 300 student visas had been revoked. Names of those targeted have been surfacing day by day. Ranjani Srinivasan, another Columbia graduate student, left for Canada after her visa was revoked and agents came to her door. She wrote in an open letter, quote, "With the rapidly escalating situation, the criminalization of free speech and imminent travel bans, what has happened to me can happen to you. We must exert maximum pressure on Columbia and other universities to protect international students from these arbitrary state actions," unquote. Mamadou Tal, a graduate student at Cornell University and a citizen of both the UK and the Gambia, left the United States rather than risk deportation or imprisonment. Before leaving, he appeared on the Democracy Now! NewsHour saying from an undisclosed location,
"What we're seeing now isn't just a crackdown on pro-Palestinian speech, even though that cannot be divorced from that, but we're seeing that any criticism of the state of Israel, any criticism of the United States government or Trump's administration, you can be liable for deportation."
Those targeted include Columbia students Leka Cordia, a Palestinian from the occupied West Bank, and Yunseo Chung, a South Korean native and green card holder who's been in the U.S. since she was 7 years old. Rasha Alouia, a Brown University medical doctor, was deported to Lebanon. Badr Khansouri of Georgetown University has been locked up by ICE, not for his activism, but likely because his wife, a U.S. citizen and thus not deportable, is an activist. In one of the most disturbing incidents, Tufts University PhD student and Fulbright scholar Rumeysa Öztürk was snatched off the street outside Boston by half a dozen masked ICE agents as she was walking to iftar with friends to break the daily fast during Ramadan. The abduction, caught on a neighbor's doorbell camera, was a chilling demonstration of the brutal tactics being used against this vulnerable population. The day after her arrest, over 1,000 people turned out to protest near Tufts, demanding her release. Back at Columbia University, protests continue. On Wednesday, about a dozen Jewish students chained themselves to two campus gates. Aharon Dardik, an Israeli-American student speaking to Democracy Now!, explained why.
"We, as Jewish students, chained ourselves earlier today to a gate on campus, and we said that we weren't going to leave until the university named who it was amongst the trustees who collaborated with the fascist Trump administration to detain our classmate, Mahmoud Khalil, and try and deport him."
Among the signs they held was one that read, "First they came for Mahmoud," a reference to Pastor Martin Niemöller's famous saying from Nazi Germany that ends, "And I said nothing. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak out." I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Earlier in the week, Amy had a piece about a film that's come out called Encampment, or is it plural? I think centers on Columbia, and Mahmoud Khalil is featured in the audio of that because he was so central to those demonstrations. Speaking of demonstrations, there are nationwide. I mentioned the one in Westside Park. Why redundancy is important. So 12 to 2. My sister's attending one in St. Louis, and they've been urged to bring whistles and cowbells to drown out the hecklers. So I don't know if they'll be heckling around here, but maybe they know their climate in St. Louis pretty well. I suggested, since she didn't have either of those items, she should bring a pot and a heavy spoon. That's a tradition that's worldwide. banging the pots and pans. Sometimes neighborhoods do them. I haven't heard that happen here as yet. Okay, here's again, opinions are those of the speakers. This is Lori Wallach, which has a bit of an orthogonal view of the tariff discussion. Just listen. Brian Edwards-Tiger doing an excellent introduction of her, so let's get started.
Tiger. Now on to the big news story of the morning. Yesterday, shortly after stock trading ended in the United States, Donald Trump rolled out what his administration was billing as Liberation Day, an announcement of sweeping across-the-board tariffs, including on uninhabited territories of other countries. The tariffs, according to the people crunching the numbers, make the U.S. the industrialized nation with the highest tariff rates in the world on its imports across the board. There's a lot of dire warnings circulating about what this is going to mean for consumers in the United States, but it's not like the trade regime that we had before this moment was exactly a panacea for everyone. So for a sober assessment of where this leaves us, we've invited on a longstanding critic of the push to liberalize trade regimes. Lori Wallach is the director of Rethink Trade Program at the American Economic Liberties Project, also a senior advisor to the Citizens Trade Campaign. Good morning.
Good morning.
What's your reaction to yesterday's announcement?
Hold on to your hat. So the administration gets credit for recognizing we need a total overhaul of our trade system, which the Biden administration had come to the same conclusion. And it is important that there is action taken that is commensurate with the fact that the status quo is unacceptable. The question is whether the specific policies this administration is proposing will fix the problem. And I disagree very strongly with their diagnosis of what the problem is, which focuses on other countries abusing the U.S. It's a much bigger problem. The whole damn system is broken. And the U.S., and namely bipartisan presidents of the U.S. and big multinational corporations, had a big part in creating that broken system. It does need to be replaced, but the misdiagnosis tends to shape some of the specific proposed solutions. That said, they actually are proposing to do, we'll see what they actually do, some things that do make sense. So it's not all downside. The one thing, and there's some very important upsides that could, who knows, come out through this. The one thing that's really clear, despite a lot of uncertainties and concerns, is, and this is critical, there is likely to be corporate price gouging. Corporations are going to try and use these new tariffs as an excuse to raise prices far beyond whatever is the actual cost that their wholesale price goes up because of a tariff. So yesterday, my organization, the American Economic Liberties Project, called on the administration to take immediate action to get ahead of that price gouging. And in fact, the Federal Trade Commission Act, Section 6B, allows the Federal Trade Commission to surveil the pricing of US companies so they can get the data to make sure they're not just jacking up prices as an excuse. And there are statutory authorities to basically under the Deceptive Practices and Acts part of the statute to penalize companies that are basically using the tariffs as an excuse to make profits on our backs. Our strong conviction is we need to replace the old system, but it needs to be the corporations that profited and frankly profiteered off the old broken trade system who should pay for this needed transition. It cannot come out of consumers and workers getting slammed again after everything that this system of trade and corporate greed has already done.
Let's put a bracket for a minute around what you want, which I do want to discuss. But let's start on what you understand the Trump administration's theory and goals to be here, because a lot of the coverage just treats this as incompetence and chaos making. Like, if you had to steel man their position, if you had to come up with the best version of what they are trying to accomplish, what would it be?
This may not square with what they're trying to accomplish, because I think one of the questions is there are conflicting goals, but there's definitely a set of folks in this administration for whom the goal is to rebuild U.S. production capacity so that instead of just mainly producing dollar-denominated assets in a super financialized economy, we are going to produce more of the goods that we need to keep our families safe and healthy. And in the doing of that, we're going to create more good jobs for the 62% of the American workforce that does not have college degrees. And we certainly
but how,
have.
How does that square with the administration putting tariffs on industrial inputs like oil from Canada that gets refined in the United States? You know, things that are inputs into the value added processes that create better paid industrial jobs.
So again, there are conflicting goals. Other people in the administration want to gain revenue. Other people want to negotiate to cut tariffs in other countries, and they don't understand the problem is on the import side, but they have the same myth of free trade of we can export our way to nirvana. And some of it is mistargeting. So one of my big questions as sort of a recovering trade attorney is why some of the countries that are being targeted for specific higher level tariffs have been chosen. Because at this point, the whole global trade system is so broken and so unbalanced that it can't deliver the potential benefits of trade. You need a system that clears, is the technical term, that's not in severe imbalance. We have a situation now where while the US is by far the biggest global chronic deficit country, there are 66 other countries in the world who are in year after year big trade deficits. And the ones you wouldn't expect, they're industrialized developing countries that also, for instance, have tariffs up against China, Mexico, South Africa, Indonesia, Brazil. Those countries have, as their sort of cause of woe, as do we, 19 countries that are chronic trade surplus countries. They use what are often called beggar thy neighbor policies of suppressing wages or consumption at home, of manipulating currency values to get a trade advantage, of subsidies left, right, and center. And those countries, China being the biggest one, but not exclusively, it includes Germany, frankly, but also Japan, Korea, Taiwan, others. Those countries are basically using a set of policies that are ostensibly advantageous for certain wealthy sectors of their economies, but are not great for their workers either. But that imbalance means none of us are getting the benefits of trade. So in my view of, you know, what should happen is you should target the big surplus countries. That's not what they did. They targeted 60 countries. So to step back, what the policy is 10% across the board tariffs on all countries, but there's a thing called Annex 2, if you look at the executive order, that lists certain sectors that are excluded. And that includes all energy products, just to deal with your particular question about, you know, oil imports. So they have taken out energy products, but there are a variety of other things that are included that, you know, one might not include. If I had a magic wand, I would take out coffee, bananas, mangoes, things we just cannot produce at scale here under any circumstances. They include in their exclusion some minerals and inputs into manufacturing. They also have a thing that is smart, but opens up a lot of cheating possibilities. And this gets to your tariffs on inputs. So excluding the oil and gas, important, but also, you know, there are a lot of parts. Over time, one would hope some of the supply chain in autos and other really important fundamental industries relating to health. So, you know, active pharmaceutical ingredients, not just the medicines, more of them being made here. Or communications equipment, sustainable energy equipment, so solar, EVs, et cetera. You would want some of that coming home in the supply chain, but in the interim, they have a rule, if you dig into the executive order, that reduces the tariff based on the US content. So it's basically creating an incentive to have supply chain investment here too. You have to start with at least 20% of domestic content, and then the tariff is only charged on the non-domestic content. So there's some logic to it, but again, are they targeting the right countries? And here's an even bigger problem. If they are aiming at really rebuilding manufacturing, what we have seen is contrasting the first Trump administration, where they did just tariffs, but didn't do any of the other industrial policies. They did not get a boom in manufacturing construction, new factories. The Biden administration actually raised tariffs considerably above what Trump 1 had done, but they also paired that with the essential other policies. So those tax credits that we all saw for EVs made in the US or for US made solar panels, that meant they were creating private sector demand, a demand for those goods. They strengthened Buy America rules, so the government buying more of that stuff. So you create demand for the good that you are protecting. Similarly, they had tax credits for manufacturing. So if you make a new plant, you get a tax credit. You are driving private sector investment. And as a result, by 2023, they had the highest rate of US factory construction investment in 30 years. This administration instead is attacking those programs like the Inflation Reduction Act, the CHIPS Act. They're trying to hoover out that money, take away those tax credits, and they have no similar plan that they are saying is the substitute. So when you look at practically what one of their ostensible goals is versus will they deliver on it with this methodology, that's where, though they get credit for seeing we have a big honking problem, the question is what they're doing deliver the outcomes, whatever the outcomes they actually are after might be.
Can you tell who's in the driver's seat Like when you're going through the text and seeing some nuanced distinctions, like that exception for imports with US-made components, like what does that suggest about who's actually contributing to the text coming out of the Trump administration?
The best way I can describe it is a stew with with various ingredients. Well, I was going to say there's some ingredients in that pot I am totally happy about. And there are some other ones where I'm thinking, who the hell invited the auto mechanic to put things into the kitchen? It's there are things that are smart. So one thing that is worth noting, California Congresswoman farther down, you know, Congresswoman Linda Sanchez just put in a bill to close what's called the de minimis loophole. It's this crazy old loophole that allows any package valued below a certain amount to be sent in to a U.S. resident every day, duty-free, inspection-free, tax-free. And it's become now 4 million packages a day, mainly from China, mainly stuff ordered online. It's become...
This is the business foundation of websites like Temu, where you buy things that are shipped directly from China, so there is no import, there's no tariff on what you purchase. It's ridiculously cheap.
And also, I might add, there's no inspection, there's no customs. It's really dangerous because dangerous stuff, fake stuff, unsafe stuff is getting into the tsunami of 4 million packages a day. Okay, one of the things in the executive order is they're closing that, which of course is a smart thing to do, is what the Democrats have been calling on, is basically what their executive order has is more or less Democratic Congresswoman Linda Sanchez's bill. But down the road, different part of the list of things in that, so that's smart. There are a lot of questions of how they'll enforce it, when they'll do it. It's not immediate. Though they do close that loophole for China, bang, shut the door, actually with the executive order. But for the rest of the world, so we'll see what happens. But then, you know, you go a few pages in and you look at the chart of countries that they're having higher tariffs. So it's 10% across the board minus certain products. And then there's a list of 60 countries that are going to get higher tariffs. And the methodology they've used, ostensibly, and this is a sort of theme of reciprocity, is the tariffs are to reflect what the other country's policies are, except that's probably not the methodology they use. They basically looked at which countries had a bigger bilateral trade deficit. So we have some global deficit countries on that target list, but also depending on the target of the tariff, they are or not actually a manufacturing problem country. So when you look at that, you think, okay, how did they pick those countries? Why would you go after that one versus I would actually do a higher rate on that one? And so, you know, to your point of who's in the driver's seat, I think to, you know, totally mix the metaphor beyond all recognition, there are a lot of cooks in the kitchen simultaneously.
We had you on some years ago during the first Trump administration, and you were pretty pleased with how renegotiation of NAFTA, what became the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement, came out under the Trump administration. There was someone named Robert Lighthizer who was doing most of the negotiating on behalf of the Trump administration. That agreement has since been crumpled up and thrown out the window by the current version of the Trump administration. I guess my question is, who are the people that are calling the shots? Are there any notable figures with relevant expertise in his immediate orbit?
Yes. So two different questions there. The person who is the new Robert Lighthizer is actually his former chief of staff. And this is a guy named Jameson Greer, is the new U.S. trade representative. And Jameson Greer is actually a smart, informed, honest lawyer. And he has, to the extent there are things in this executive order that make sense, a lot of that is his being very knowledgeable. And I would say he is focused on the goal of rebuilding U.S. production capacity, trying to keep out the imports of those chronic surplus countries, the mercantilist countries, the countries that use the policies in their own production that make it nigh impossible for even the most excellent U.S. producer or producers in other countries to possibly compete because it's a form of basically trade abuse. So he is there. There are other folks who are involved in this who I would say are less informed on some of the details or how to translate the theory of what you want to do to the policies. And then there certainly are some folks in the administration who just have a totally different view. The Treasury Secretary has continued to talk about targeting a handful of countries to try and get them to cut their tariffs so we can export more, when the actual problem of these imbalances is on the import side, targeting those 19 severely mercantilist countries, you would have a lot of trade rebalance and there's no way to export our way out of it. So I think it's a little bit all over the place. The one thing I want to go back to though, is even with all of that, one very clean, clear thing we need to be doing, and a lot of members of Congress are starting to think about this, is we need to get a thing that they are not including in their executive order now, and they have not talked about, which is anti-price gouging action. So again, the current Federal Trade Commission statute has both existing authority to surveil what corporate pricing is. We've heard all of these earnings calls. We have corporations saying things like, well, in anticipation of tariffs, we're just going to raise prices. If they are raising prices unrelated to what their actual higher cost is, that is price gouging. And not only does the Federal Trade Commission statute, Section 6B, allow the Federal Trade Commission to surveil pricing, but the Deceptive Practices and Acts Authority allows sanctions against it. It is one thing if the increased cost from a tariff is passed on, which, by the way, sadly, there's so much concentration in particularly retail, and there's such record high corporate profits amongst the big companies and such record low corporate taxes, they are well situated to absorb the additional tariff cost in many circumstances. Because just so your listeners are clear how this works, when there is, say, a 25% tariff on something, the tariff is charged on the wholesale. So the Nikes that cost $120, they've set that price because they've done research knowing that that is the price at which they'll have the largest unit for the largest number of volume of sales. So they will basically, they know if they go $130, bigger profit margin, but less units sold. Yet the shoe comes in from Vietnam or China, and maybe it's $24. Literally, the markup is like that. And so the tariff would be charged on the wholesale. So when it comes in, that would mean $24 shoe, 25% tariff, $6 is added to the price. So now the cost for the retailer is $30 for a shoe that they're still going to send for $120. So there's a margin in there where the extra cost can be absorbed by taking it out of the profit margin. And that, by the way, the sort of best studies of what happened with Trump's first term tariffs on $350 billion of stuff from China, 20% on average tariff rates. That's largely what happened. You know, we didn't see those tariffs went into place 2018, 2019. We didn't see inflation jump until COVID. It was mid-2020. So that didn't trigger inflation. It didn't trigger a lot of prices jumping. But this time around, on all these earnings calls, we have heard lots of corporations making noises about raising tariffs, whether or not raising prices, whether or not they are facing tariffs. And so that price gouging action is going to be critical, because otherwise we could actually
see. And so just to be clear, the theory here is that all the coverage around the tariff increases produces cover for a company that wants to raise prices without inducing sticker shock in its consumers. If people are already expecting price increases, you can get away with a lot more.
That's exactly right. And in fact, you know, the story we always hear is in Trump's first term, he raised tariffs on washing machines. And we hear the story, washers and dryers prices went through the ceiling thanks to the tariffs. The only hitch to that is, it is true that the price of dryers went up. There were never tariffs on dryers. It was just the hype of washer and dryer. They kind of go together, salt and pepper. And so the companies just decided that they could get away with it. And they did. And then the prices were raised way more than the actual cost the tariff put into the wholesale. And the prices went up, like in Canada, for washers, a lot more than even what the U.S. tariff was. But there was no tariff in Canada. So it's exactly what you describe. It's using the excuse. And, you know, it would be a horrible double whammy if all the hysteria attacking tariffs for raising prices led to higher prices.
Lori Wallach, I guess the other question that we haven't really addressed is consistency. There have been so many announcements and reversals and re-reversals just in the past couple months of skirmishing with Canada and Mexico over tariff rates. If you look at this as policy, it's hard to say which policy private firms making investment decisions are supposed to calibrate to.
That's right. So I think that there are, you know, five big questions about whether we are going to see the outcomes perhaps one could accurately describe as what Democrats have been asking for in trade since before NAFTA and WTO, which is a more balanced, more fair system that works for working people. The goal of that compared to the outcomes and questions around the actions taken yesterday, that, you know, number one, what is the real goal? Is anything about manufacturing the real goal? Is this about gaining revenue? What is the goal? Number two, though, is how long are they going to put these tariffs in place and keep them? This gets to the certainty and to consistency. So the on and off roller coaster of tariffs we've seen in the first 2.5 months of the administration, that's not going to have any investor agreeing to move their money into building a new factory in the US. And for that matter, it's not even going to make a sourcing agent in a company that's finding intermediate parts for construction here of some good likely to change the sourcing, because you don't know what's going to happen the next day. So when you have this kind of roller coaster of on and off tariffs, you end up having investors more likely to reach for a barf bag than a checkbook. And the problem there is they've spent 2.5 months playing that game. So now, even if they've put these tariffs in place and they intend to keep them in place, everyone's assuming it could all disappear overnight. And that is a real problem. The use strategically and successfully of tariffs involves consistency and leaving them in place. So they're going to have to not be doing one-off deals, doing exceptions on and off again for some months before they're likely to attract any sort of certainty. And next problem is, by the way, related to that.
Oops. You know what, Lori? I just took a look at the clock and we're not going to have time for the next problem, but maybe we can have you back on again soon. Thank you so much for speaking to us this morning.
We'd love to. Thank you.
Lori Wallach is director of the Rethink Trade Program at the American Economic Liberties Project. She is also senior advisor to the Citizens Trade Campaign. That does it for Upfront this morning. We are weekdays at 7 a.m.
Brian Edwards Tiekert with Lori Wallach. As mentioned, I remember when she was with Global Trade Watch. And it's a bit of a dissident view. I mean, the idea that there actually are a few competent people in the Trump administration kind of maybe strains credulity a little bit, but she's quite in the mix of it all. I'm wondering whether the next problem she was going to talk about was cronyism, and we've already had a grand example of that. Trump basically threw the law about TikTok out again and gave a 75-day extension and said something about if Larry Ellison of Oracle gets to buy it, then maybe he would lower some tariffs on China. It's sort of cronyism writ large, it seems to me. But whoppers come so quick and fast. It's hard to believe. All right, this next segment is a bit nerdy, as I like to say, but hits people, a lot of people, where they live. I'm not on Social Security since I'm through the state retirement system, having my own burdens there with the collapse of Health Alliance. Or it being collapsed by the management, who would rather get into Medicare and other kind of advantage programs, I suppose, since those are so lucrative, as opposed to a health maintenance organization predicated on the idea of keeping costs down. Oh, well, that's just me. Opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared. Remember, there's a Boneyard Arts Festival all day today, the musical part of the WEFT scene, 40north.org, to get all the details, starts at 4 o'clock with a trio of young women musicians. You can probably find that on the website, because I want to go on and get most of this on, including J.B. Pritzker's talk from this week that I hadn't heard broadcast anywhere else, that I happened to hear yesterday on This Way Out. I had on deck something from last week's demonstration. I'll probably have Dean Baker on tomorrow. I wouldn't be surprised. He's a regular go-to guy for one of the producers I like out in KPFA, and I'm sure he's got a lot to say. Maybe agreeing or disagreeing a little bit, Lori Wallach. The main thing is that the system status quo ante is also not working. There is a diagnosis that needs to be made, but using reputedly AI to generate this chart, and that's maybe why the uninhabited island with penguins was listed as being under trade sanction. Hard to believe. So Nancy Altman is with Social Security Works, which you'll hear introduced by Mitch Jezerich right now.
Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. A new Gallup poll released today shows that those who were surveyed, about 76% of those surveyed, were either a great deal or a fair amount concerned about Social Security. On top of that, about 87% of the people were either a great deal or fairly concerned about the economy And about 85% of the people were either, again, concerned or a great deal concerned about inflation. Of course, all of these go together, and we know there are a lot of fears right now about what's happening to the Social Security Administration. And today, that's what we're going to be talking about. My guest for this conversation is Nancy Altman. Nancy Altman is the president of SocialSecurityWorks.org. She's the author of such books as The Truth About Social Security. She's a co-author of that book, as well as another book that's called Social Security Works for Everyone. Nancy Altman, I thank you very much for taking time to join us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Nancy, we have a hard end time with you at 50 minutes after this hour. And today we want to take listener calls and emails, because we know a lot of our, you know, radio listeners tend to be, let's say, mature. And we know a lot of people out there are worried about this very issue. So I'm going to give the phone number out much earlier than I usually do, because I think we really want to hear from listeners about their concerns and questions concerning Social Security. And the phone number to give us a call is 1-800-958-9008, 1-800-958-9008. And to send us an email, just write us at letters@kpfa.org. Again, that's letters@kpfa.org. If you give us a call, I ask you to keep your comment to about a minute. And if you write us an email, I ask you keep it to about 2 to 3 lines. That allows me to eyeball it before I decide whether it's appropriate to bring to air or not. Most of them are appropriate, but, you know, Nancy, sometimes you never know. Nancy, let me begin just by asking you, we don't want to make people – Social Security is important. People rely on Social Security to make it by in retirement, or if they're disabled and unable to work. It matters. It's important, and we don't want to – unnecessarily worry of people about this. What's the reality of what's happening to Social Security right now?
Well, if you had asked me this last summer, I would have said 100%. This program, it's served the test of time. It's in its 90th year. It was enacted 90 years ago, and I would have said it'll be here 90 years and beyond. Now on, it'll be here for our children, grandchildren, and their children. I no longer feel as confident saying that because of what the Trump administration is doing, and in particular, what Elon Musk and his 20-year-old Doge bros, people call them, who are really in charge of the Social Security Administration now, in charge of all of our most personal data without any real oversight or knowledge to what's going on.
So talk to me exactly what they are doing. Now, there's a different sort of, we should probably separate a few things. We're not seeing a reduction in benefits at this time. What we're seeing is a reduction in the actual administration that administers Social Security. Is that accurate?
Well, it's actually a little bit worse. We are not seeing a reduction in benefits, and we shouldn't see a reduction in benefits. That's the job of Congress, that you can't do through administration. But the Social Security Administration, the executive branch, is in charge of determining how much people get and making sure that it's transmitted accurately, in full, and on time. And for 90 years, they have done that. But we now have they have hollowed out the agency. So it's not really an exaggeration to say around 1,000 years of collective wisdom and knowledge has left the agency since January 20th. That's people who've worked there 30, 35, 40 years, whose parents might have worked there. It's one of these jobs where people feel very mission-oriented and are really concerned about it. So it's been hollowed out. They're talking about it's all at a 50-year low in terms of number of staff, and they're talking about firing thousands more employees. So at the very least, there's no question that wait times and backlogs are going to increase. But the real fear I have, and again, as you said at the beginning, I don't want to scare people, but it's something to be really focused on, is that they have Elon Musk and the people who work for him have our most personal sensitive data. But beyond that, and nobody knows what they'll do with that. Nobody's ever had that kind of access. The commissioner, the president, no one has ever had the full access. They usually, when they're audits and it's highly audited, they look at the information they need to have to do their mission. If you're working in the agency, that they have access to everything, including what they call the source codes, the programming. And the fear that a lot of people have who are much more expert than I and worked in the agency is they could bring about a collapse. And if that were to happen, at the least bad thing would be improper payments, where some people would get too much and some people would get too little. But it could be that benefits will actually be disrupted. I don't know that it's likely to happen, but it's certainly not. It's something that, again, before all of this started the last few weeks, I would have said, no, these are automatic. You've got very well-trained people to make sure that these payments go out. This is conspiracy theory nonsense. Now, because we don't know what the Elon Musk's people are doing, I cannot assure people of what is happening.
Last month, Martin O'Malley, who headed the Social Security Administration under President Biden, warned that the cuts could result in the cuts in administering and staffing the SSA could result in the agency missing payments for the first time in history.
And that's exactly right. He's talking to the same people that I'm talking to. And these are the people, first of all, the people who have been fired or have been forced out of the agency are the people who deal with cybersecurity, who make sure that our data is kept safe. But they're also the ones who maintain the website, who maintain the systems, who maintain, make sure, because things are always changing. People die, and obviously their benefits are terminated. Other people start claiming, reach retirement age. Some people become disabled and receive disability benefits. So there are always people who are maintaining it, putting people on, removing people from it. Those people have all been forced out. And so, and the people who that are still remain, we are told, have been the DOGE people are not telling them what they're doing. So they have no insight to what is going on. And because they have no insight, it's impossible for any of us. Now, we have a Congress that's supposed to perform oversight. And if they were doing their jobs, they would bring Elon Musk in front of the committees and ask him why he has access to all this data and what is he doing with it. But of course, the Republicans in Congress are not doing that.
Again, we are speaking to Nancy Altman, who's president of SocialSecurityWorks.org. We are talking about the state of Social Security right now. All right, thank you. Yeah,
very good question. So as has been widely reported accurately, every year there's a trustees report that comes out of the Social Security Administration. It's required by Congress. It's a report to Congress. It's come out every year, wartime, peacetime, whatever, because it's to make sure that Social Security can always pay its benefits. And the caller is exactly right. It's a defined benefit, can pay those benefits in full and on time. And the actuaries have been projecting a shortfall. It's manageable in size. But if the projections are that around the early 2030s, 2034 around, Congress has to act to make sure there's sufficient revenue to continue to pay the benefits. Now, there's obviously you can bring in more revenue, you can reduce benefits, or you can do some combination of the two. But the American people are very clear, poll after poll after poll. This is one where you have MAGA Republicans who agree with progressive Democrats that the benefits, if anything, are too low. They should not be cut. And instead, the very wealthy should begin to pay what a lot of us think would be their fair share. And indeed, Congress and the Democrats have introduced legislation. The now ranking member of the Social Security Subcommittee of the Ways and Means Committee has introduced legislation that has about 90% of the Democratic caucus that would actually increase benefits and would, both across the board and in targeted ways, and restore Social Security to balance so those benefits can be paid in full and on time. And the Republicans have not offered a counter proposal, which is what the Democrats keep insisting they do. And so that has been ongoing. And I've been told that if the Democrats had taken control of the House in 2024, or if they can take control in 2026, Hakeem Jeffries, who is a co-sponsor of that legislation and would be Speaker of the House, will bring it up for a vote, which I think will put an interesting pressure on the Republicans, because their donors don't want to have to pay more, but their voters want Social Security benefits increase. So that'll be interesting. But what's going on now is I worry that as many of the older listeners will know, President George W. Bush in 2005 campaigned on privatizing Social Security. And I give him credit because that proposal was out there in the open for all of us to debate, and the American people said no. And even a Republican-controlled Congress did not even take it up for a vote. I'm afraid that the Trump administration learned the wrong lesson. Donald Trump went around the country saying he would not cut benefits, but Elon Musk called it a Ponzi scheme, and they were hollowing it out. And I'm afraid they're trying to destroy it from within. So I do think there's been talk about outsourcing its administration. And I know this is a long answer, but one more sentence on this. And that is that right now, $1.6 trillion flows through Social Security every year. You know how much Wall Street gets? Zero. You know how much is paid for administrative costs? Less, about a half penny of every dollar spent is spent on administration. More than 99 cents goes out in benefits. That's much more efficient than you find in the private sector. And if these benefits, if this administration is outsourced to the private sector for-profit companies, a lot of our money will go not to benefits, but to in the pockets of the people.
So you see this as potentially outsourcing, in other words, privatizing the administration of Social Security?
Exactly.
Wow.
It would take legislation to actually privatize the benefits, which is what George W. Bush proposed in 2005. But outsourcing it is something the administration could do, and looks like they're heading to force the agency to collapse and then say, see, government doesn't work. We got to get the private sector to do it.
I mean, that's what it feels like is happening in a large scale here.
Yep.
Not Social Security. I didn't even think of
it. All across the government. All across. Yeah. There's a lot of talk of privatizing lots of parts of the government. But what I consider somewhat unique is that the Social Security Administration, those monies, that doesn't add a penny to the deficit. Our same dedicated revenue, the FICA that's taken from our paychecks, goes not just to pay every penny of our benefits, but also the associated administrative costs. And that amount it should be about a penny. It's been starved of resources and the income is too low, but it wouldn't be the 10 or 15 or 20% you often see with private insurance and 401ks and other kinds of.
I mean, I certainly have thought of George Bush's push to privatize Social Security in 2005. I was a Capitol Hill reporter at that time, and that was the first time I started seeing people protesting at the Capitol for the first time, like physically showing up at the Capitol. I was only there a few couple years before that. And it was a third rail, and he touched the third rail. And I always thought that was the beginning of the end for George Bush's second term, which sort of became a disaster after things went bad in Iraq, Hurricane Katrina. But I think it all sort of started with their attempt to try to privatize Social Security. Went really bad for them politically. And I think this would be a lesson for Trump to keep in mind now. Mary writes in to us, my primary question at this moment is, will I get this month's check? Now, Nancy Altman, I don't know if you have any experience as a benefits counselor, and obviously you're not omniscient, so nobody knows for sure.
Well, if you had asked me this a few months ago, I would have said 100%. We've been getting those benefits have been paid on time in full the program was enacted 90 years ago, the 1935, and the first benefit check went out in January of 1940 and has never missed a payment. As I say, pandemics haven't caused it to, recessions hasn't caused them to stop. Wars have not caused them to stop. So I would have said, don't worry about it, relax, it will be there. But I don't want to scare people, but I do want people to be aware and really put pressure on our Congress, because for the first time, I don't feel I can assure you of that, because we just don't know what they're doing with the systems, which are the internal infrastructure that makes sure that the benefits are paid out. They're paid out by Treasury. Of course, DOGE is all over Treasury as well. But the reporting of who should get benefits, what amount, and when, that all comes through the Social Security Administration. And DOGE is rummaging through all of that information. And who knows whether they're changing it or could it just inadvertently create a problem. Again, the IT experts I have talked to are worried for the first time.
Good morning.
No, very good question. And the Democrats have proposed, as I was talking about that legislation that Hakeem Jeffries is the co-sponsor of and will bring up, that includes exactly what you're talking about, raising those thresholds. And in fact, eliminating or lifting the amount so that, you know, $50,000, $100,000 of income to have to pay is, I think, is the right policy, and it's very popular with the American people. But here's the rub. It has to be paid for, and the Democrats do pay for it by requiring people who are earning over $400,000 to pay. There's now a cap on the maximum amount that Social Security contributions are collected on, and that's $176,100. So they don't lift it completely, but they require those earning over $400,000, with incomes over $400,000, to pay FICA contributions on their full earnings and unearned income as well. And that takes care of the across-the-board increase and targeted increases, including that taxation of benefits. Now, the Republicans, Donald Trump ran on eliminating the taxation of benefits, and that's a very popular, but what he doesn't do and what the Republicans are not doing is paying for it. And one thing that's not well understood is that the money that is paid for on the taxation of benefits doesn't go into the general fund. It is dedicated to Social Security. It was a compromise that came out in the 1983 amendments when the Republicans wanted to cut benefits and the Democrats wanted to raise taxes. And this was a proposal that basically they could say, hey, it does both, because it taxes the benefits, that's a tax, but it lowers your effective, you know, your net benefit. So that's a benefit cut. And the money goes back into Social Security. So if that taxation was eliminated, that represents about 4% of Social Security's income. And that means that that exhaustion date that we were just talking about, that depletion date when Congress has to act, instead of being in the 2030s, it might be in the high, you know, 2028, 2029. And that's a problem. It has to be paid for. And it's not clear that Republicans will do that.
Piggybacking off what you talked about, what happened in the 1980s, Tom writes into us, different agencies in the federal government are able to borrow from the Social Security Fund. I believe Ronald Reagan initiated this policy. There are huge IOUs, I presume. Why can't the government call these IOUs in and recoup the money to help shore up the fund?
It can and it is. I mean, Social Security has, from the beginning, had two sources of income, and now it has a third. The first source, which everybody knows and is the primary source, is the federal FICA contributions, which really are, I think of as premiums for the wage insurance. It's disability insurance, life insurance, and retirement annuities. But it's a current funded, so the money coming in paid by workers is paid out currently to current beneficiaries. But there's a reserve that's kept because it cannot pay a penny of benefits unless it has sufficient income to pay all the costs. And so the money doesn't, so if there's more money coming in than going out, sometimes there'll be more money going out than coming in if it's a recession. But if, for example, like in the 1990s, when you had the baby boomers all in their peak earning years, a lot of money was coming in. And the money isn't just put under a mattress, it's invested like any other trust would invest. But from the beginning, Congress has said, well, we don't want to invest in equities. We want to invest in the safest investment on earth, which are treasury bonds backed by the full faith of the United States. So it's been since 1937, when there started to be contributions paid, that money has been invested in treasury bonds. And there are currently about $2.7 trillion of reserve. That's a surplus. An accumulated surplus of $2.7 trillion, all invested in treasury bonds. Now, because Congress has not acted to increase the revenue, that is slowly being drawn down. And that's why in 2034, if Congress were not to act, and it is inconceivable to me, I think there is zero chance that Congress will not act. But in the theoretical sense, if Congress didn't act, those treasury bonds would have all been redeemed. There'd be no more assets in the treasury, in the trust funds, and Social Security would still have enough income to pay 80% of benefits. So current beneficiaries would still be getting 80%, but of course, that's unacceptable. You've got to be able to get 100%, and that's why Congress should and will act. And I hope they act by expanding benefits and requiring the wealthy to pay more.
So at some point.
So that's Nancy Altman of Social Security Works, socialsecurityworks.org. That's where that's from, Ms. Jezerich. I promised some Governor Pritzker, so here he is. We'll get to a part of this. The demo is in an hour or so. People are gathering there already out in Westside Park, I guess. I guess Indivisible Champaign County is the sponsor, among others, I suppose.
One of the speakers at the star-studded Human Rights Campaign's annual Los Angeles dinner on March 22nd was Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker. The Democratic firebrand has become a leading alpha liberal, advocating for aggressive opposition to Republican authoritarianism. Here are some highlights from Pritzker's passionate address.
I first got my start in activism right here in the state of California. As a little kid growing up in Silicon Valley in the 1970s, my mother was an activist for reproductive rights and LGBTQ rights. And she took me to pride parades back when, well, they weren't really parades, they were protests. So I have to laugh when I hear the right wing carry on about the dangers of exposing kids to trans people or same-sex couples, because I'm living proof that introducing your kids to the gay agenda might result in them growing up to be governor. Now, my mother marched and fought at a time when the advances in LGBTQ rights of the last 20 years would have been unthinkable. But she understood something important about the legacy that we leave our children, that the greatest thing that a parent can do for the next generation is plant seeds of freedom in the hopes that their kids are able to one day take refuge in the shade of a fully grown tree. What is so dangerous about the moment that we find ourselves in today is that we're watching the most vile and cruel people in our country take an axe to the trees planted and nurtured by the most courageous of Americans. For 10 years, ever since Donald Trump descended that ridiculous gold escalator to announce his entrance into the political world, I hoped that the Republican Party would seek out and find its better angels. Hope is a delicate and wonderful thing, a seed that we should never stop planting. But I won't let hope be a blindfold. And I won't continue to advocate that we wage a conventional political fight when what we really need is to become street fighters. Now, let me be clear, the Trump administration and his Republican lackeys in Congress are looking to reverse every single victory this community has won over the last 50 years. And right now, it's drag queens reading books and transgender people serving in the military. But tomorrow, it's your marriage license and your job they want to take. Bending to the whims of a bully will not end his cruelty. It will only embolden him. The response to authoritarianism isn't acquiescence. Bullies respond to one thing, and one thing only, a punch in the face. At its core, what Elon Musk and Donald Trump are doing isn't about efficiencies or cost savings. It's about giving their wealthy friends a tax break and making the middle class and veterans and public school kids pay for it. Meanwhile, the scariest part is that they're using the power of the presidency to try to delight their base by targeting vulnerable people, people they think can't fight back, calling them domestic enemies, or claiming they'll ruin American culture. Remember their slogan, "Make America Great Again." Authoritarians target vulnerable minority communities first because they think that if they can conquer those that they deem weak, and they can show everyone else who's boss, which is why we can't sit back right now and wait to see what happens. If we wait, I guarantee you the battle will have already been lost. Donald Trump cannot take anything from us that we don't choose to give him.